This is Corporate Watchdog Radio, bringing you news, interviews, and commentary on corporate sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Fair trade or foul? The world confronts a choice. Today we look at what's at stake for poor farmers around the world and how fair trade activists are supporting them. We talk with entrepreneur and fair trade pioneer Dean Sikon. And in today's commentary from the Business Ethics Network, Brian Campbell tells us what we can do to help cocoa farmers. But first, headline news. We're going with just one today, and it's related to our theme. Last week, the final round of the World Trade Organization's Doha talks collapsed. The trade deal fell apart over allowing poorer nations to erect tariffs on subsidized imports of farm products from wealthy countries. Such tariffs were historically used by the United States and Europe during their own period of development. But now, trade representatives from those nations refused demands by India and China to allow a special safeguard mechanism to protect small farmers in the developing world. The Doha talks were supposed to help the poor by addressing trade inequalities between rich and poor nations. Laura Russo of Oxfam America says fair trade is a great way of pulling people out of poverty.
If we were to just increase, for example, Africa's share of international market just by 1%, it would create the funds that are upwards of 5 to 10 times as much as Africa gets in aid by every single donor every year. It's a huge opportunity. But the system is unjust. The system is rigged right now.
Oxfam America has started a campaign called Make Trade Fair, and you can find out more about it at oxfamamerica.org. That's our headline for today. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Dean Sikon has long believed in using business to promote social justice, and fair trade is his bailiwick. As founder and CEO of Dean's Beans Organic Coffee and Cocoa, he's helped small coffee farmers around the world get a fairer price for their product. He's worked with farmers from Papua New Guinea to Peru, build cooperatives and their clout on the world market. And he's listened to them, the stories of their lives and their work. Sikon's put his experiences together into a terrific book called Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. When co-host Bill Bowie and I asked Dean how he got into the coffee business, he told us first he founded a charity program called Coffee Kids. Through it, coffee companies gave money to help the families of poor coffee farmers. But Dean Sikon soon realized the companies were getting nice publicity, but
they weren't changing their business practices. So life in the coffee villages really wasn't going to change. There was some nice charity, but there was no social change. And that wouldn't happen, I realized, until the businesses changed the way they dealt with the coffee farmers. So that's when I decided to try to model a business that incorporated social justice and progressive social change as a very foundation of the business. So it was an experiment. You know, I was not a business person who woke up one day and said, oh my God, I have to do nice things in the world. I was a social justice advocate who was looking to use business as a vehicle for change. So I was less concerned about profit than I was about the process of social change.
Have you been able to make a profit doing social change?
Well, that's the funny, you know, that's the really funny thing. I didn't expect it. But Dean's Beans has been profitable since day one. We're now 15 years old, and we have a profit margin of about 12%, which is very, very good. And we also grow at about 15% a year, sometimes 20% a year, which is interesting since we don't have a sales or a marketing staff. It's all about word of mouth. It's all about grassroots sharing of information. And I think people really respond to the values we represent, obviously the good coffee, it has to be a high quality product, the way we relate to the farming communities, and the transparency with which we operate. You know, you can go online and you can look at our contracts. You can look at the very contracts we sign with the farmers. You can look at the organic inspection certificates. It's all up online. We hide nothing. You know, there's no, Starbucks isn't telling you what they pay for coffee, although they have major advertising campaigns to, frankly, deceive you into what they want you to think they're paying. But the truth is they pay considerably less than we and many other people pay.
Another difference that you just touched in on and that really informs the book is that you are connecting directly with the farmers, that you're going to the coffee fields where things are grown. Explain how that model came about and how that model helps your business to operate and how that could be, you know, can that be integrated into the Starbucks and the Procter & Gambles of the world?
When I decided to start Dean's Beans, it was based on a community development model. So I had already had experience working in the field, and I also had a couple of years of international development experience before I went to law school. So I kind of understood about community connection. But what's really interesting is in the business world, that is completely exceptional. That is not the norm. I was at the United Nations Human Rights Commission 2 months ago. I was asked to speak about integrating human rights into a business. So in the audience are Coca-Cola, General Electric, Telecom Italia, Rio Tinto Zinc, all the biggies and many of the nasties. And so I just put on a slideshow showing them the coffee farmers and the projects we do and the relationship. I said, human rights is about humans. You know, we've been talking about programs and processes. These are humans. So I started to talk about how we do what we do. And afterwards, pretty much every one of those companies came up to me and said, you know, we can put out a great product and we can send it around the world, but we don't know how to deal with communities. They have no concept of it. It's not what they do in business. When I go to Ethiopia, I sleep with the farmers in the huts, you know, and we sit around in circles and talk, and it's very human. A week after I left Ethiopia on my last trip, one of the senior vice presidents of Starbucks went to the same area, and his experience was quite different. He got there. It was a platform. They put him on the platform. They had a bunch of dancers come out and dance in front of him. Then they left. He gave a speech. The people left, and he left. You know, the hierarchical model, which businesses are accustomed to, is antithetical to community development. And so that kind of paradigm shift has to happen. And it's not, you know, it's not really that dramatic. It's just about treating people with dignity and treating people as if you're really in community with them.
I wonder if I could ask you to talk a bit about Papua New Guinea, not only because this is probably one of the most hilarious sections of the book, but actually because it really talks right to this and almost the most extreme environment that someone from the developed world could think of. How you connected with the farmers, the tribal people of Papua New Guinea, and also because they themselves are really not used to a community model either, unlike some of the other places you talked about.
That's a very interesting point. Papua New Guinea is an island that has 846 different tribes, all very small, with small territories, and speaking mostly mutually unintelligible languages. So the impetus is not for community work there beyond the small environment of each community. So creating cooperatives in Papua New Guinea has been very, very difficult because people are suspicious, fractious, and their default is to just protect their family and not trust other people. So what I was doing was going around and meeting with small village groups late at night over a big campfire, brewing up Dean's Beans, their coffee, roasted by us, brought back, brewing it up in huge kettles, which is not my preferred way to make coffee, but what are you going to do? You know, in these little villages that are a collection of huts with no electricity, no running water, no schools, and basically talking about the need for cooperation if they're going to get education, if they're going to get a higher standard of living, which they want. Having said that, we came out of there forming two cooperatives. Now, you know, 4 years later, one of them is very strong and the other is very weak, but they're still around and thriving, and we just helped one get its organic inspection renewed, and it's on the Fair Trade Registry, so it's bringing in at least three times the amount of income that would have had without that kind of intervention. But I find that, once again, you know, talking on a very human scale with people about what do you want? What's your dream? What's your goal? And finding out that whether someone's sitting there in front of me with a buffalo horn strapped to his penis and a bone through their nose, or they're sitting there in a business suit, at the end of the day, they ultimately have the exact same desires. They want a house. They want food on the table. They want their children to get educated and have a better life than they do. Now, it comes out in different ways, obviously, but the very basic human need for respect and comfort is there. And that's what I go for when I'm there, not talking about money per se or organization or international recognition, but talking about how do we achieve the basic human goals we're all looking for and do it together.
Well, tell us a story that you tell in the book about how you did convince maybe that first group about cooperatives. I mean, they were saying that they're used to doing things as individuals, not even as tribes. And so set the stage for us. Tell us how that happened.
Well, when I got there, there was so much excitement about someone coming to help them as opposed to someone coming to buy their product and rip them off. I was the first white guy, frankly, and the first coffee roaster to go up into these villages since World War II. First coffee roaster ever, but first white guy since World War II when an Australian soldier got lost up in the Eastern Highlands. So it was pretty unusual, and since the majority of the population is below that age, a lot of them had never met white guy. So it was quite interesting. And, there was a lot of that kind of, skin touching and yanking on hair and looking up my shorts kind of thing. What's going on in there? Every time I went to the bathroom, crowds would gather to see, what do you got that I ain't got sort of thing. In fact, they built me a toilet, which was great in one village. They took coffee bags and built a three-sided enclosure over a hole dug in the ground, which was very, very nice, except that the fourth side was open to the communal sitting area where we were all gathering about 80 of us in a circle. So when I, after Amoeba Central had to use that facility, it was like pretty hard to do. Yeah, basically waving. And so the children gathered around me and they were all staring. So I thought, well, I'll scare them off by barking like a dog because dogs are scary out there. So I started barking like a dog, and they must have thought that was some sort of an American toiletry behavior. So they all laughed and started barking, and more people came and watched me, and it just, but again, a very humanizing thing. No suit and tie on that trip. But afterwards, we sat for hours, and I talked about the world of coffee because, like with most coffee farmers, they grow their product and then let it go to somebody and never see it again. They don't know what it looks like processed. They don't know what it looks like roasted. And they don't know what it tastes like because they don't generally drink coffee. They grow it and sell it. And they don't have Mr. Coffee Pots and they don't have electricity. So it's just not something they do.
We're talking with Dean Sikon of Dean's Beans Organic Coffee Company and author of Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee.
So I always take back the coffee of the people I'm visiting, roasted and packaged with their name on it, so that they can see that they're seen and known and respected outside of their communities. And once that kind of respect has been established, then people are more open to hearing the message about what the expectations are out there in the world and what the rewards are. Both monetarily and in the sense of self-respect and in terms of what community development can look like. What I also do is I always bring a photo book of farmers around the world to show people what other farmers look like, what their lives look like, and I always tell stories. I just did this in Ethiopia in last November, my last trip. I sat around in a hut with about 10 coffee farmers and their 30 kids. It was a big hut. And I told them stories about sort of the customs and cultures of coffee farmers in other places. And it blows their mind because most of these people have never left their village. So to all of a sudden see the housing of farmers in Papua New Guinea when you're in Ethiopia, and hey, those people, not only do they look like us, but they grow the same crop. Oh, they have the same problems. Oh, but they do things differently. It's just really exciting and opens up people's world.
And it strikes me, Dean, that what you're doing is also sort of combating the fracturization that is used against coffee farmers, that coffee farmers are manipulated by not having any sense of connection to the sort of supply chain that's involved in their products. So what you're doing sort of metaphorically is also doing what we're talking about of changing the business model.
Absolutely. And that's also one of the primary dynamics of fair trade in general. It's not just Dean's Beans. the fair trade movement, whether people involved in it who buy fair trade coffee here but aren't involved in the deeper issues, whether they know it or not, what they're doing is participating in breaking down these barriers that the industry has set up to basically to prevent the coffee drinker from knowing what's going on in their name in the coffee villages.
Some folks criticize the idea of fair trade or the idea of mixing social good with profit as being anti-globalization, and that's somehow very Luddite and, you know, 16th century, although actually 16th century was a great time for globalization as well. But you're really saying that, no, it is about globalization, but a different model.
Well, globalization can't be stopped. Globalization's been going on since the first indigenous peoples crossed the river and traded with the other folks, which is an interesting point, which is why I found since the 80s that village banking, you know, micro-enterprise models that we incorporate into our development work actually fit really well with indigenous societies because they're very used to commerce. So it's nothing for, I was just in Guatemala 2 weeks ago, it's nothing for indigenous women in a rural Guatemalan village to get a loan and start a business and create a little economy. That's what they do. That's what they've always done. And so there's always been trade. There's always been commerce. There's always been an exchange of ideas. What's happening now, of course, when we talk about globalization, it's not that per se. It's the abusive economic exploitation of other peoples. You know, there's been globalization for a long time. Whether it's positive or negative is how we work with it. And that's why it's essential that social justice and ethics are incorporated into global schemes. And this goes back to the very point that Bill was raising before. It's how do you integrate these things? Because the basic model of business relies on those vast distances to keep people ignorant. The consumer is ignorant of the actual price somebody paid for something way down there. Oh, it's only $40. Yeah, well, they paid a buck, you know, at best, right? They're ignorant about the conditions people are working in, but the advertising that we get here leads people to believe that everybody's smiling and happy and Juan Valdez is a happy guy with a big mustache and a mule. Well, that's not the reality of coffee farmers hardly anywhere in the world, except the owners of large plantations who benefit from government connections and all sorts of nasty things. But, you know, breaking down that barrier to allow the free flow of information is one of the positive aspects of globalization, and that has to be kept up in order for people to get the what happens in their name, whether it's clothing or coffee or cars or anything else. It's the same process. Basically, you know, fair trade is not a type of coffee. People have to understand that. Fair trade is an economic relationship. Every coffee bean in the world can be traded fairly. It's not, oh, there's 10 pounds of fair trade coffee over there. But under the formal fair trade program, there are several thousand cooperatives around the world who are formal fair trade cooperatives. Of that total of cooperatives, only about 20% of the coffee they produce, which is fair trade eligible, is actually bought under fair trade terms. So I can go to that co-op in Peru and I can buy a container of fair trade coffee from them, and I can also buy a container of coffee under conventional terms if I want to, even though it's the exact same coffee. It's the economic commitment that I make that determines whether it's fair trade coffee or not. In fact, one of the early scams in fair trade from some of the larger companies was exactly that. An exporter representing a large corporation in the United States would go to this cooperative in Peru and say, okay, we'll buy a container off you at the fair trade price, but the other three containers we're going to buy off you, we're going to buy at less than the market price, so that the ultimate sale is actually maybe even less than what you would have gotten. They get punished for it. And I heard that from farmers in Peru, I heard it from farmers in Colombia, and I heard it from farmers in Brazil. So it wasn't some mythical thing some one farm group was making up. It was going on, and the exporters are doing that. So unless you have a direct relationship with the coffee and with the people, there are really no guarantees about what's going on in your name. And also, you know, when a company is 1% or 10%, even 15 or 20% fair trade, people have to realize that what they're doing is subsidizing that with the 80 to 99% non-fair trade coffee that they buy. So they're making money hand over fist. And, Yeah, a couple of farmers are getting a couple cents more, but fair trade is way more than merely the price you pay for coffee. It's supposed to be long-term relationship. It's supposed to be pre-financing to the farmers who go through periods of months at a time before the harvest when they don't have a dollar in their pocket and they don't have food for their family. They need that money up front, not months later. But very few companies, especially the big ones, participate in pre-financing, even though it's one of the requirements of fair trade. So fair trade is more than just a price. It's a whole ethical package of relationship that requires people to go deep.
I asked Dean to tell us about a very powerful chapter of Java Trekker called Death Train. It's about the trains coming from Mexico's southern border with migrants from Central America headed to the U.S.
I'd heard about the death train from Nicaraguan farmers who told me that, especially during the serious pricing crisis from 1997 to 2005, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of coffee farmers in Latin America, over a million worldwide, lost their land, were thrown off their land. And so many of them in Latin America tried to come up into the United States, as they do 100,000 a month, you know, right now. Every day people are coming up, trying to get in to better their lives and send money back home.
And this is when the coffee prices collapsed.
Yeah, the coffee prices collapsed in 1997, and they plunged to, on the worst day, it was about 35 cents a pound. Now, today, the world coffee price is $1.30, to give you an example. What it costs a farmer to process and grow coffee is about 65 cents a pound. So back in those days, every pound a farmer was selling was pushing him deeper and deeper into poverty and despair until, bam, they lost their land. So hundreds of thousands of farmers lost their land, went into the cities, and then tried to come up into the United States. They crossed the border between Guatemala and Mexico and then tried to go all the way up Mexico and cross into the United States. And they rode the death trains, these large freight trains that start at the Guatemala-Mexican border and end up ultimately at the U.S. border. The problem is they're freight trains, so people, as you say, have to sit on top, they have to hang on the sides, and sometimes they go 8 to 10 hours between stops. And if that's at night, people are very tired and it's raining and the branches from the trees are whacking them, or the Mara Salvatrucha, the gangs that are all over Latin America, most of them trained in the prisons of the United States, and then people thrown out of the country and reforming gangs all over Latin America. The Mara Salvatrucha would rob them, rape women, throw them off the train. Some died. And some got sucked under the train by the vortex of the fast-moving train and had their legs and arms cut off. They ended up being thrown into hospitals by the police and then collected by a number of small service organizations, usually run by nuns or religious organizations, that gave people basically a place to stay. But these victims, many of them coffee farmers, and I interviewed a lot of them, they're in limbo. They can't come to the United States because they have no arms and legs. They have no way to get here and do work to send money back to their family. They can't go back home because they're totally in shame because they failed to support their family and now they're going to be a burden. And the third aspect is they can't stay in Mexico because they're illegal and the Mexican government doesn't want them there. So we figured out the best thing we could do is help people get therapy and then job training and then try to find job placement back in their home communities or in their home countries so that the people could support themselves. Well, you know, we're a small organization and we worked with Polis Center, which is headquartered in Petersham here in Massachusetts. They're a disability service and rights organization. And we worked together to create this program. And at this point, we have, I think, 8 or 10 people that have gone through this and have been repatriated with job skills that are working. One guy, Nelson, who lost his leg, was actually given a job in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of El Salvador in charge of repatriating other people similar. And I took Nelson and bought him a suit because he had just one set of clothes, bought him a suit for the interview. And when he put that suit on and came out of the dressing room with a suit on, he said, "Look at me. I've never had a suit. I feel proud of myself for the first time in my life." It was profound.
Dean Sikon, thank you so much for joining us here on Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. This is a great program.
This is the weekly viewpoint from Corporate Watchdog Radio, a commentary from experts in corporate sustainability. Today, Brian Campbell of the International Labor Rights Forum tells us about the plight of cocoa farmers and workers and what we can do about it.
Everybody loves chocolate, right? But do you know what went into making it? Not the products, the labor. For over 100 years, the cocoa and the chocolate we love to eat has been produced under some of the worst labor conditions in the world. 40% of the world's cocoa is produced in the Côte d'Ivoire, West Africa. The U.S. Department of State has estimated more than 100,000 children work under the worst forms of child labor in that country. Some 10,000 or more are victims of human trafficking or enslavement. In 2001, the large cocoa companies like Mars, Hershey, Cargill, and Archer Daniels Midland bowed to increasing pressure from consumers and politicians to clean up their supply chain. They agreed to establish an industry-wide certification program by 2005 that would tell consumers which chocolate was produced without forced or child labor. It was a groundbreaking idea. A market-based approach to ending child labor would empower consumers to be a part of the solution. The reasoning was sound. Time and again, economists have found that if consumers are given information about producers who don't use child labor, those producers will be rewarded with higher sales and profits. And children who would have been enslaved will instead have a chance to have a childhood, to go to school, and to have a better life. Incredibly, the companies failed to meet both the 2005 deadline and a second extended deadline this past July. Instead, they passed the buck for ending child labor to the government of Côte d'Ivoire. The companies then pushed farmers to grow more cocoa. They've told the farmers that higher production would lift them out of poverty. But expanding cocoa production will likely just make farmers poorer. That's because it'll reduce the price companies pay for cocoa on the world market. More work for less pay won't end poverty. Labor standards, encouraged by thoughtful buyers, will. Congress has called on industries that use child labor, like cocoa, to use a market-based approach to ending child labor. In this year's Farm Bill, Congress directed the U.S. Department of Agriculture to work with industry, labor experts, and agriculture experts. It wants them to design a voluntary program that will tell consumers which products are child labor free. While no one certification program can truly guarantee a 100% child labor free product, third-party certification programs, such as Fair Trade Certification, can help cocoa farmers around the world boost their incomes, reinvest in their communities, and end the worst forms of child labor. But we don't have to wait. We can show the chocolate companies now that the market can work for poor cocoa farmers in Africa. By purchasing Fair Trade certified chocolate bars, we can be part of the solution to help end child labor in Côte d'Ivoire. For more information on ethical cocoa companies and other steps to end child labor in cocoa farming, check out our chocolate company scorecard at www.laborrights.org. For the Corporate Watchdog Report, commentaries from Ben, I'm Brian Campbell from the International Labor Rights Forum.
Thanks for listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio.
We broadcast on over a dozen Pacifica and independent community stations nationally, from Alaska to Vermont.
Check us out on the web at www.corporatewatchdogradio.org.
There you can subscribe to our podcast and listserv. You can also hear our archived interviews and commentaries with the likes of Bill McKibben, Francis Moore-LaPay, Paul Hawken, Hazel Henderson, and John Elkington, among many others.
Thanks to CWR co-founder Sanford Lewis for hosting our podcast.
Email questions and comments to corporatewatchdogradio@gmail.com.
And tune in next week for more on sustainability and corporate accountability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.